Well, hello, good afternoon, welcome, and Sláinte to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz, once again broadcasting from an undisclosed location in Guelph, Ontario, coming to you live here on CFRU 93.3 FM, your campus community station. And I am joined as per normal, as per usual these days, and as prior to the COVID situation, Adam A. Donaldson, our chief assignment editor and of Guelph Politico and of various projects throughout the land. Adam, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Excellent.
How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. So far, so good. no complaints? No, can't say that. This whole show is a show of complaints. No, it isn't really. Just kidding. So, anyway, coming up on today's show in the second half, we will talk about the reopening of Parliament. Should it reopen? Has it reopened? What the heck is going on in Ottawa? And of course, we will have our weekly COVID update. At one point, COVID update was entire shows, and now it's part of a show, but it is still very much on the radar. And in the first half, we will have a discussion about should the police be defunded and who is talking about that and why and where. But right off of the top, we will start off with a topic that is still very much in the news, and that is initially, I believe we were calling this topic Black Lives Matter protests, but I would extend that to BIPOC as well. The way things have been going in the past week or two. Adam, your thoughts on that situation so far this week since we spoke last? To put you right on the hot seat right away. This is how we
roll. There's a lot of complicated thoughts. Yeah. I think, there's the American story and there's the Canadian story. I think the big one in the United States is the killing of Rashad Brooks, who was sleeping in his car in a Wendy's parking lot when the police rolled up and they talked to him for 25 minutes, gave him several sobriety tests, and then when they gave him the breathalyzer, he supposedly failed it. And then they tried to take him into the custody, at which fight, you know, a kind of physical altercation ensued. And Rashad Brooks grabbed the taser of one of the officers and ran for it. And then he was shot twice from about 18 feet away. And, I mean, that's significant because people who know police training and police tactics will tell you that, when you're within 21 feet of somebody, the length of time it takes for a suspect to close on you and the same time it takes for someone to draw their gun, aim, and shoot is 21 feet. So there were other options in the situation, and it was all the more galling because it happens in the midst of all these protests about Black Lives Matter. It happens again, you know, with cameras being pointed everywhere. We have another example of excessive use of force, and in breaking news, the officer who did the shooting yesterday, it was announced he was charged with several charges, including felony murder. He has turned himself in this afternoon to the Atlanta PD, and so he will be, I'm assuming he'll be arraigned either tomorrow or maybe even the next day. So that's sort of the latest concerning that. And I guess on from the Canadian side is, I don't know if anybody saw the actual clip of Jagmeet Singh, the NDP leader, being expelled from the House of Commons after he called blockhouse leader Alain Therrien racist when Therrien was the one person who stood in the way of unanimous consent of a motion that acknowledged systemic racism in the RCMP and a direction to look at ways to overcome that. So I guess those are the two sides of the I guess BIPOC Lives Matter, if we're going to extend it that way, that debate and those issues going on this week.
Yes, and just for airtime, I saw that the Bloc is demanding direct apology from Singh. I think this is probably going to go on for a few more days, if not I was going to say forever. It won't go on forever, obviously, but it definitely became top of mind. I did see Singh yesterday becoming quite emotional at his press conference talking about the motion. The Bloc had made some kind of point that, like, well, there's a committee that's taking care of this anyway. et cetera. So it's that's for them to fight out, and I think it's going to it's going to go on well into the weekend probably and beyond. But going back to Richard, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say it's one of those weird situations where the motion was sort of largely symbolic and largely, you know, ornamental, that, you know, it's a statement of principle, I guess. And, you know, those things are easy to, and I've seen it happen at our city council at times where, you know, something you think that would go through easy and would be a statement that all of city council could get behind ends up becoming a way for the councilors to fight about their own internal politics. But, you know, this really was one of those things where it should have been really, really simple. And all it takes is one person to say, well, I don't think we should be doing this. And then it becomes a whole thing. But, you know, I also understand Jagmeet Singh's, at least I think I do, you know, where he's coming from on this, you know, being the one party leader who is a person of color and
ever.
Has probably
ever
definitely experienced racism firsthand. So,
oh, for sure. And that's the thing. All this, you know, unanimity minus one is no longer unanimous, and so that's that. But so we're seeing degrees. I think everything from, as you say, this motion of symbolic gesture to, and I have to mention it, but I don't want to talk about it too much. The, you know, Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben's, all of that, all of a sudden being analyzed after 100+ years of these products. We're getting down into the nitty gritty, the brass tacks of things that are perceived and are actually systemic racism within. I've heard the Aunt Jemima discussion before. It's back. They're going to change it. You know, all of these things happening almost sequentially. I'm not saying that that's a minor issue, but in the scheme of things, compared to what happened with Rayshard Brooks, but also the speed too, because what we saw with his, which I'm going to say it, it's pretty much an assassination. You shoot somebody in the back who is running away with a taser that supposedly would not work, and the police knew that, you were assassinated. Right. That's opinion. Right. That's just, but the amazing part of it is how quickly body cam footage, other footage came out, an analysis of all of like the speed in which that happened, because there's so many events that have happened in the past that are just kind of pushed aside. And in particular, I'm thinking of the one that came to light this past week, and it's Canadian, but has made global news considering. Mm-hmm. Not global TV, but the worldwide news. it was on global TV as well. The situation, and I'm sure you saw this, Adam, in Ajax, where an elderly black couple who had some sort of heated discussion with somebody at the hospital, this is 2 years ago, were on their way out. They were approached by police, beaten up, like really, really beaten up by the police. It wasn't just manhandled. It was, if I understand it, the man of the couple was really assaulted, essentially, right? And they haven't seen, and it just sort of went away. So no one's been talking about it. Now this has come to, I think it was Muhammad Lili is where I first saw it. He was with CBC, right? Mm-hmm. Now with ABC, it doesn't matter where he's from, but the first tweet I saw was from him saying, I'm working on this. And it just went from there. Also, one out of Edmonton, I think it was 2019.
Yeah, that's the one I thought you meant. It's it's August. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is the thing. They just keep surfacing and surfacing. Here's another video of somebody getting a knee on their neck, almost daily for the past week, and sometimes two and three incidents. Also, would have mentioned I saw like a blot out version, didn't watch the whole thing of that, the blackface video of the two teen girls from Montreal. A province in which the premier is saying, no, there's no systemic racism, but yet a video like that is presented. And it's like, well, you know, these are your people in Quebec. How doesn't this speak into systemic racism? Everything from Aunt Jemima to blackface. Like, really? Right? So. Yeah. The speed in which things are happening is fast, and there's a range of incidents occurring. I wonder whether the steam of this is going to continue at the rate that it is. You know what I mean? Like, is all of this going to surface and come out and keep coming out? And are hard changes going to be made beyond getting rid of a racist product. Like, is are we going to say, we're going to get into it, I guess, in topic two, in terms of defunding the police, which is one of the key things. But it just seems bottomless.
Right. It's
but racism is bottomless, right? I mean, not to make light of it, but it's like, yeah. So,
well, I was going to say I was listening to the Upper Grand District School Board meeting on Tuesday, which they were having a special meeting that I think was probably initially about the. Actually, I'm not sure what it was about initially because it seemed to come together pretty quickly. But it was about, you know, sort of the equity policy and the equity work that the board is developing, but also about this motion that was brought forward by the chair, Martha McNeil, about looking at police presence in schools. I mean, that's a little bit separate, but one of the things I found interesting in listening to the people present the equity plan for the Upper Grand Board was that the curriculum that they want to bring forward is to not teach, you know, how to be nice or how to, you know, re-educate, you know, racism. It's to teach kids anti-racism and anti-oppression because of the systemic problems that it's not just a matter of like, oh, like you have to correct someone when you say things. Like they want to change it from just being like an individual one-on-one basis. And of course, making it that way also makes you focus on the girls in blackface, that kind of thing, because that's just blatantly racist. That's obviously racist. But what it doesn't do is look at the things that go into making a system racist so that, you know, when cops see anyone who's not the color white, they start thinking it's a matter of guilty until proven innocent. And I think that's maybe the most direct way to frame it, right, is that for a lot of people people of color in our country, they are guilty until proven innocent. They are followed around stores until they are either they leave or the person who's following them is assured that they're not going to steal anything. That's when we're talking about systemic racism. The blackface stuff, the Aunt Jemima stuff, absolutely. It's, you know, you can feel the racism coming off of it, but what Upper Grand is doing, I think, is rather shrewd, is working at it from a more deeper level, which is saying, like, not only how do we identify racism, but how do we get rid of racism by looking at it through anti-oppression, from an anti-oppression lens.
Yes, all very necessary. And if I understand it right, have I got it right that the University of Guelph is also going to make sure that all students have anti-racism training in the fall? Did you see anything about that?
I did see that. I haven't had a chance to read the details yet, but yeah, that is
pretty much breaking news. But yeah, so I would hope.
But I mean, it's anyone who's been involved in like a university club or hired by, you know, I worked for the CSA in some capacity, so you know. You would always get the safe space training. You'd get the anti-oppression training. That was part of your transfer of power for when you would come in onto a position. But you know, you'd have to be part of the CSA staff or whatever to take advantage of that. And now it's going to be, I guess, universal anti-oppression training for everyone coming in.
So that is something. I hope they would extend that to the entire campus as well, not just students, because that might go a long way. So yeah, so like I said, there's a lot been rolling in the past week. Mm-hmm. And again, we could probably give this topic a whole half hour as well, but this probably leads into topic number two, was the Rodney Levy shooting last week. Mi'kmaq man in New Brunswick, mm-hmm. who was in mental health distress, and also the woman that was originally from BC. I'm not sure what her indigenous group was, Chantal Moore. Again, it's something that was a wellness check, and she was killed in some kind of altercation with police. And if I understand it right, since April, 9 indigenous people in Canada have been killed by police, by RCMP and other police groups. So this leads into topic two.
Well, before we get into topic two, I just wanted to add, there was a federal protective service officer who was shot and killed, another one that was wounded near a Black Lives Matter protest in Oakland. And so the two got tied by proximity, unfortunately. But it turned out that the person charged with that is a white man named Stephen Carrillo, who it turns out is part of – not only is he an Air Force officer, it turns out he's part of this Boogaloo movement, which is this sort of new branch of white extremism, where they kind of have very loose affiliation and very loose ideology. But, you know, it turns out that what they all want is a second civil war, which would basically be a race war. And so just, you know, it's another reminder that as peaceful protests, largely peaceful protests go on, you know, the violence that police should be concerned about is from these extremist groups, some of whom are embedded in law enforcement or military agencies. And this is a prime example.
Yeah, and
Stephen Carrillo.
They're one of those ones that's tough to figure out. Like, did they just sort of come to being via the internet? Because it's always like they're loosely connected, and they have all these symbols, like Hawaiian shirts, right? Isn't that mm-hmm. and open carry, of course. And are they libertarians, or who are? Like, it's weird and disturbing at the same time. And of course, with everything that's going on, it's like, well, maybe this is the kickoff for the civil war that they want. I don't know where that's gonna go, but obviously if they hadn't caught those people, they probably would have blamed Black Lives Matter protesters for the death of those police, right? But they seem mm-hmm. to have a handle on this person and managed to get weapons and not a confession, but something from them, right? Wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But so anyway, the you know, having said that, police being working on that case. But then, of course, the other channel to this is the question that keeps being asked this past week, past couple of weeks. Some people have been asking it for years, maybe decades. Do we defund the police? Should we defund the police? I've heard some of the talk that I've heard about defunding the police. There are a lot of people that will say, we don't mean getting rid of the police altogether. It actually means taking money and resources away from them that could be used to do other things, such as mental health supports for people and a framework of other things mm-hmm. that would take care of people kind of on a separate channel. Now, I mentioned it last week and did a bit of reading up on it. The Camden, New Jersey case, where the police force was in a shambles, spending a lot of money, assaulting and killing a lot of people, and crime hadn't gone down. In fact, it had gone up. So what they did was pretty much a reset. But it also involved not just getting rid of the police force, and I think they pieced it out to the county. I guess it would be kind of like the Guelph Police becoming part of the OPP, something of that kind of structure. But they also had to, according to what I was reading, had to get rid of the police union as well, which was very strong, reluctant to change. They just did a complete reset. Again, you know, not perfect, but it sounds like the people there are happier with the outcome. Crime is down, and they have been working on getting other people involved beyond the police to do what was formerly policing things. And I was also reading up a bit about they've come up a couple of times as an organization called Cahoots in Eugene, Oregon, which is a sort of a funny-ish name, but they do very serious work. I think it stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets. Supposedly they've been at this for about 30 years. And Cahoots, it's Eugene and Springfield. I guess that's our Simpsons reference for this week, but well, they had a picture of Springfield, Oregon, and they have a giant mural of the Simpsons. So I guess they've adopted them. I don't know, but 24,000 calls this organization took on a $1 million budget, whereas I think the police budgets are generally much much higher than that. I think theirs is many many more million. They're doing 20% of the work that the police used to do, and I guess they do call they will call 911 on occasion, but of 24,000 calls. Being able to take care of that aspect of it, and the majority of them, it sounds like, are mental health people mm-hmm. in mental health distress that don't need police necessarily to come and help them. These are the kind of things that people are talking about when they say defund the police and give the money to another organization.
It's complicated, right?
Because
because you want like a tight, punchy slogan, but
as opposed to FTP, right? Which is right. You've gone from which is a fairly negative thing to defund is a bit more. You can have a discussion there, right? You know.
But I think, and I mentioned this in my Today column last weekend, it's just it's a new way of thinking because for 40 years, the automatic assumption was that more police is good. Giving money, more money to the police is good. That is a worthwhile investment. And, there are probably examples where, investing in the police has turned into a positive thing for a community. On the other hand, the ACLU in the United States did an analysis in Boston, and that they found that in Boston, they spent 5 times as much on the police as they spend on public health.
Wow.
And on top of that, 530 members of the Boston Police Department made more money than the mayor, but that's neither here nor there. What I found interesting, though, is that number that it was 5 times more than public health, and it was like 7 times as much on, things like homelessness and, whatever way you slice it, the police department is always sort of like the biggest part of the budget, especially in the United States. And what you hear from police, including Guelph police, is that more and more they are being asked to do things that are very non-police, mm-hmm. like those mental health checks, like those wellness checks, things like domestic disturbances, things that require you to have a very different skill set. And again, going back to the United States, I found another number that I think I might have lost somewhere here. Okay, here it is. The Georgia Association of Chiefs of Police did an analysis of how much training police officers get. And in Georgia, they have one of the lowest. And maybe that's why Atlanta is like this hotbed of so much, activity about police brutality and use of force. 408 hours is the average. 408 hours of training for a police officer.
Like total?
Total.
Really? Wow.
And
that's super low.
Right. And you got to think, what do you think the focus of that training is?
Yeah, like electrician training is like 10,000 hours.
No way. So, but what do you think they're focusing on in those 408 hours? Is it how to talk someone down from a high stress situation? How to talk to somebody with mental health concerns? How to de-escalate using various therapeutic psychological methods?
Yeah,
no, it's how to draw your gun, point it at the target, and shoot where you want to put the bullet.
Yeah,
and
because
chokehold people.
Those kind of trainings are probably like a morning seminar or a day long max, right? About how to seriously, that's how it's probably working there. But that this is the thing. The point I was going to make was you mentioned mental health care and social services, and it's like, and how the police aren't equipped to do that. And there are some places. I believe, isn't it in Waterloo, they will have somebody come and ride along if there are people that they can call up and will come on a call. But there's that still involves like a middleman or a middle person and having to address that. But if some of the discussion is like, well, if they increase funding, not even taking it away from the police, but if they'd increased the funding that was chopped from social services and restored the mental health care that had been chopped over the years, all these successive things that have been eliminated by all governments of all stripes generally, or housing, another good example, right? Mm-hmm. The government in Ontario, at least, and in other places, lots of places, has gotten out of the housing business. Those are the main three things for people. The security of the person is housing, mental health, and the social services to back all of that. Having eliminated all of those, that snowballs into the situation where you have many, many more people that need these things. And as we said, the police aren't necessarily the people to look after it. And adding to that with more being added to police budgets and police in lots of places becoming more militarized, more weaponized to get all the toys, and having what we know as that cop attitude, that is showing itself over and over again in everything that we've seen, not just in the past week, but in, you know, over many, many years, once everybody had a phone slash camera slash video camera in their pocket, then we, you know, we see the result of that. And this is possibly going to be one of the most important discussions of the age, I think, not just in North America, but in other places in the world.
It's a difficult discussion to have again, because we've sort of, again, spent 40 years saying to ourselves, police are good. We've been sort of programmed by, you know, pop culture. Even the bad cops have a reason for being bad. Or if it's a movie about corrupt cops, there's always the one cop.
The rebel cop. Yeah, right.
The rebel cop who's good. And it's so funny because I was watching an NCIS rerun the other day, and it ends climactically with like five agents shooting the one bad guy. And it's like, it's designed to be this triumphant moment of this horrible person being, after multiple episodes of, you know, taunting NCIS, he's down for the count because everyone gets a chance to put a bullet in him. But, you know, that's brainwashing, isn't it?
He wasn't black, though, right?
No, he was British.
He was British.
Sorry,
I'm not just... it's that old trope, the... not angry English. It was English, probably English, right? He definitely wasn't a Scottish guy. Yeah, it doesn't. No, we've totally derailed here. But I know what you mean, though. Like, it's, yeah.
The point I was getting at is that, you know, it's difficult enough for us in the public to sort of overcome these biases we have in favor of the police. And I haven't seen it talked about a lot on the news today, but there was a story yesterday that there were officers in the Atlanta PD, where Rashad Brooks was shot on the weekend, shot and killed. Mm-hmm. After that officer was charged with felony murder and several other charges, several officers in the Atlanta PD went on what they call a blue flu, which is, you know, when police are upset about something happens to a brother or sister in uniform, they do this job action where they suddenly call in sick, and that, of course, has a cascading effect.
Yeah, the sick out, right, is what union people call it. But yeah.
Usually it's a sick out, you know, that kind of thing when they're looking at pay cuts or job cuts or that kind of thing. But in this case, it was coming to the defense of an officer who, it seems like, murdered someone in cold blood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of attitude that's going to make these conversations that much harder.
Well, and like the situation in Buffalo, too, where the police that knocked over that... elderly protester who it sounds like pretty much won't walk again and may have brain damage and has a cracked skull, but it's like thin blue line stuff. They just, you know, support them hell or high water. And I believe that has changed as well, because when you see that video of the cop, the one by his, you know, naturally wants to help, and the other guy's like, nope, just leave him there leaking head on the pavement.
Mm-hmm.
So over and over again, we see this, and this is a very important discussion to have. It is obviously taking place in lots of places, and we will be, including in Guelph, I think, a little bit. But we will get to that in a future episode, for sure. So anyway, we're going to take a bit of a break now. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, heard every Thursday from 5 to 6. We're going to play some PSAs and some messages, and a little bit of music to take a bit of a break, and we will be back very shortly. To know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Yeah, we'll meet again. I don't know where, and I don't know when, but I do know that we'll meet again some sunny day. Yes, a little taste there of the great Johnny Cash, supposedly one of the last songs he ever recorded, And that was We'll Meet Again, very popular during World War II and popularized by also the great Vera Lynn, who passed away yesterday or early today at the age of, I believe, 103. If you want a lesson on how to inspire a nation whilst not being a politician, look no further than the mighty Dame Vera Lynn. So,
I thought you were going to say, if you're looking for an inspiration in longevity, look at Dame Vera Lynn.
Yes, and not Johnny Cash. But wasn't sure whether she had died of natural causes or COVID. It wasn't specified. But there's a lot of people out there probably like, oh, she was still alive? Yes, indeed she was. So,
maybe de Havilland's still alive.
Oh, yes. She's going to break some records probably in terms of Hollywood, right? But anyhow, I was going to, not speaking of Hollywood, although it is a factor because we're watching lots of films and things on lockdown. COVID still with us. Yes, I made the comment last week and it holds this week, and you'd made it on our webpage as well. It's like, does it's still on, by the way. that's number one. Because I've seen quite a few people out there that have this feeling that it's not around. And of course, there's been a lot of announcements. Of course, one of the biggest ones this week was that the CERB that a lot of people are on. Do you know that number, Adam, in terms of how many people in Canada are? It's millions, right, that are on the CERB benefit?
I don't have it off the top of my head, but
it's definitely in the millions. Has been extended for beyond. It was supposed to run out the first week of July, and the program has been bumped forward, I guess, to the tune of another, once that $8,000 is maxed out, we'll go beyond that for a total, I think, of 24 weeks for people that are on it. Extended for 8 weeks.
8.41 applications.
Yikes. So that will continue on. And of course, with that, and I guess we'll get to that in the next part too, about how much that is going to cost, because there was a bit of a budgetary update today, costing a lot. But that's something, I guess, to help with people who are still without work. Things are creeping back, but they're not exactly flying back in terms of business and jobs. So that number is probably likely to stay high for that 4 week period. Although I'm given the impression that there's steady progress, as Doug Ford would put it, in terms of reopening the province and reopening the economy. Although we've seen places such as Brampton and Mississauga, and down in Windsor, Essex, too, which I'm not sure how much of that is directly related to the temporary foreign workers and the seasonal agricultural workers that have cases, but those places are still stuck in stage one for the time being.
Mm-hmm. I would gather most of that is that the issue with the temporary migrant workers. I think Mississauga and Toronto, the Peel area, can pretty much be tied down to just density and how many people there are. You're talking about 5-6 million people.
And they like their backyard parties and they just don't care. No, that's not fair, but as an ex-Mississaugaite, I can see it. Yeah, density probably too. And Toronto, of course, which is still ghost townish, I suppose, to a degree, but the state of emergency has been extended to June 30th. Is that right? So there's...
Yes, it's till June 30th, although they are thinking about extending it to July 15th now.
Oh, that's... And that was something else that Doug Ford said. Don't let your guard down. But this is what I've been noticing just around town, that there are, and through anecdotal stories and through the news, that there are a lot of people letting their guard down. From a national or international example would be that the people... A couple of UK nationals flew to New Zealand and totally trashed New Zealand's COVID-free status, right? Managed to travel, didn't quarantine. I believe there's a similar story. Was it a doctor in New Brunswick who was taking a lot of flack? A doctor, somebody who should know better, was like, nah, didn't really quarantine, has COVID, and then there's more COVID cases. As to whether they've been traced...
He said he didn't do it, though.
So he didn't do it, just like Bart. because I don't know, they haven't been traced back to him, but I'm sure if they did the in-depth contact tracing. And did you hear we're supposed to be getting this? I keep hearing about these apps. Canada's going to have an app. UK's going to have an app, but nothing appears. Like, what is going on with that? It's like, oh, there's going to be an app. And then there is no app. Is anybody in the world, maybe China, actually using an app to help prevent or to encourage contact tracing, but prevent the spread of COVID. Do you know of any functioning one? I just go, oh, there's going to be an app. There isn't one.
Not off the top of my head.
Right. See, so it's not just me. It's like, what?
Well, I mean, the discussions of privacy are vastly different now. But I think there are considerable issues of privacy if you're talking about collecting data and using people's phones as a way of tracking public health information. That can go to some pretty scary places.
Oh, true. Yeah.
And I think if there's probably a holdup there, I mean, it's like the internet voting thing, right? Everybody thinks like, how hard is it to set up internet voting? It's like, well, the idea isn't hard, but in order to do it safely and securely and while maintaining your privacy and your right to a secret ballot, it becomes actually incredibly hard. And I think it's a lot of the same thing with these apps and stuff.
Yeah, it's almost as if by saying there's going to be an app, people feel, but oh, great, there's going to be an app, and people will be like, oh, that's fantastic. That'll fix everything. U.S. still raging away. It doesn't sound like it's going to get any better, and I don't think any Trump rally is going to help. I believe that the rally in Tulsa, and it sounds like people are already there. I saw a couple of little bits on Twitter of people all excited about the Trump rally on Saturday. No masks, no anything. I got
Trump
it right that they
June
said you...
famous.
Yes, and the Juneteenth, exactly. There's a lot of people out there that know what the Juneteenth is. No, they didn't before. Do you know if it's official that people aren't allowed to wear masks at the Tulsa rally? Like, masks have become verboten in anything, any Republican Trump circle. It's like, no. We don't like the optics of masks because it implies that people are sick, which they are.
Well, I think the only caveat is by securing a ticket to go into the rally, you are forfeiting your right to sue the Trump campaign if you do get COVID-19. I think that's really the only condition. I don't imagine they're going to say, you're going to walk in there with a mask and somebody's going to tell you, take that mask off. The people who stand behind Trump definitely won't be wearing masks. But for people out in the crowd and maybe not within the sight of the camera, they'll probably be okay.
I think the loophole would be if you had a Trump mask or a Keep America Great or mask.
Oh, yeah.
If you had a that would probably mask, pass. Yeah. Or yeah. Something insulting Hillary.
Oh, for sure.
Who isn't even in the running. Now, I'm wondering if Trump is still on the hydroxy because the FDA pulled the emergency authorization for it. So it'd be like, why be on it? I'm fairly sure that he probably wasn't really on it. It would seem the evidence shows that hydroxychloroquine is not effective at all and it's probably caused more harm, which sounds like lots of circles knew that already, but it wasn't out. Although... there seems to be some kind of breakthrough with the steroid. And the problem with these announcements is that who was it made the comment about sort of managing your COVID response by press release saying, oh, there's this steroid and it has, is it dexamethasone? Common steroid. Yeah. It's a breakthrough. It'll help people. I think usually when there's a situation like this on, they probably find out by accident. It was like, hey, this person is on this. And the effect on them wasn't as bad, whereas somebody equivalent in the next bed, not so good. So,
right. I mean, this
was
is kind of the
pushed.
Problem when you're doing science, science in the news, I guess. When you think about other public health challenges like HIV/AIDS or cancer or, ALS, there isn't reporting every day about how that disease is ravaging people. I mean, it's not as contagious, obviously, but there's such desperation for a vaccine because we've heard from public health officials their things will not be reopening or we will not get back to quote unquote normal until there is a vaccine or like a regular shot or that you can get for something like this. And I heard somebody say this in an interview. I was watching something and they're saying like, we've put so much money on, or we put so many chips on getting the vaccine to get back to normal that we completely discount the scientific process and how, we may get close to a vaccine, but then all of a sudden we discover it, causes, spontaneous combustion or something. Getting the vaccine is sort of not the end of the story. It's not the end of the return to normal because there's still so many rigorous things. We would have to know what the side effects are. There are 100 different vaccines being in development, but it's theoretically possible that none of them could work.
And also, if the I was going to say the thing, because it is the thing, but if this version of the coronavirus mutates in some way, then that's another wrinkle.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there is the case of Tracy Schofield down in Cambridge, who tested 13 times over 76 weeks, not 76, 16 weeks, I guess.
Yeah.
76 days. So she tested 13 times to get her two negative tests for COVID-19. She basically had to assume she had COVID for 76 days before she got, you know, the all clear. She just got her second negative test this past Saturday. It was her 13th test. And apparently she's not alone in being people who repeatedly test positive for COVID weeks and weeks and weeks after it should that 2 week period where it theoretically should have passed out of their bodies. And there is some speculation. Again, it's unproven because there's so many unknowns right now, but you know, that it's possible for some people COVID might be a chronic condition that they face for a longer period of time. And what happens, like, could we theoretically get some sort of vaccine where you take it, your COVID symptoms are relieved, but you know, it could be something like
you could be a super spreader and not know it.
Back every now and then, right?
Yeah.
So there are so many unanswered questions.
Yes,
and I think people are just so focused on it being over that they don't really understand that that's another one of those things that's easier said than done.
And it could be the kind of thing like the flu that'll just be always with us. I'm hoping that's not the case. And there seems to be a lot of positivity in terms of vaccines and vaccine work and treatment work too. Because even if there was no vaccine, if they could double down on treatments such as this common steroid that supposedly helps. But there's still no cure, people. You need to remember that. And I think people have lost sight of the fact that how there's like almost 500,000 people worldwide have died. Mm-hmm. 450,000 is the count. It's a grim number, but it's and a grim reminder too. I believe in the U.S. and I hate comparisons like this in some ways, but to give it some perspective, they said more people have died in the U.S. 117,000 than did in World War I, mm-hmm. which was a bloodbath. So these are the things to be mindful of. And it's 8,250 in Canada so far.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to have to say so far, but that's this story is going to be with us a lot longer. And those that have to deal with it at the federal level are in Ottawa. And we did talk about what's going on there a little bit earlier, but should Parliament reopen? I wasn't having trouble with this topic, Adam, but when you Google it and say and look into it, most of the grumbling about Parliament not having proper sittings was in April, when it was becoming clear that the Liberals were going to say, no, we're just going to do this and have the committee style structure, which I believe that expired yesterday, right? The official mm-hmm. COVID committee period expired. I have to ask you this, like, what was the end result of that? I just saw, okay, the COVID committee is going to expire. All the business happened with Singh, and I don't know if it buried the story in terms of where Parliament is going to go next. I take it they're just going to continue with the hybrid sittings of, we're going to have some MPs, we're going to have a lot of people on the monitors, but it's not gone any further than that, and Andrew Scheer's head is going to explode because, it's, among others.
Well, the deal reached a couple of weeks ago was that they would continue with the hybrid model. You know, it was a bit different before, where it was all online, and then there was the sitting a couple of times a week, and then they moved to a model where there was
some people there,
the some people in the house, and then everyone else was on like sort of two big screens at the end by the speaker, and that's the model they've been working on the last few weeks. The intention was to wind down because you know Parliament does wind down at the end of every end of June for a couple of months. Everyone goes back to their constituencies for a couple of months and then resume back in September. I think they are, well, I know that they're planning on meeting again because it was announced yesterday that there's going to be a, not a straight up fiscal update, but a quote unquote snapshot of the state of the economy coming on July the 8th. So they'll probably be sticking in Ottawa. The ones who are in Ottawa will be sticking around for an extra couple of weeks to deal with that.
I wonder if this is the longest they've gone other than, say, the war in terms of presenting a budget. They've just been able to bump it. Because it was supposed to be, what was that, in March? Wasn't that right around when everything was happening? The budget was supposed to come down. And of course, this is red meat for conservatives in particular, but others are like, we need a fiscal update. We need to know where this is going. And I don't, and as you know, it's not often I agree with conservatives, but it would be probably something. A snapshot is something, I suppose. But when some of the numbers from the officer gave today, what was it for? Sorry, I've lost track of mine here, but the amount of the, is it $525 billion total is possibly what the deficit is going to be, and adding in what's gone on with the emergency benefits? It's high.
Yeah.
It's really high. And that kind of stuff gives conservatives palpitations and people who, I mean, it is cause for concern, but as to whether how it's going to be tackled is the other cause for concern. But in terms of the actual sittings, I did find it. I think we were talking about this before, that the Constitution says that the Parliament only has to sit once a year. Mm-hmm. And that goes way back. And then it goes way, I don't know if it goes back to like Magna Carta or whatever, but that number itself, if they've sat once, that's fine. They normally sit for about what, 26 weeks? Mm-hmm. Sit for half the year, and then the other half a year that's supposedly constituency work and off to the cottage or whatever, like other people do. But supposedly this will be a record, the record for the least number of days sat ever in a session. I think it's something like 38. Mm-hmm. So as to whether that's super cause for concern, they seem to be getting some business done, and all things considered, it's not so bad. But I believe that there isn't going to be proper sittings until September at this point. Is that right? They're hoping that September things will be...
Yeah.
I guess the hope is that things will be cleared up and they normally would start sitting in September. It's late September though, right?
Yeah.
And once
that is all correct.
Right. So they're hoping at least in September that things will be, I don't want to say clear it up, but maybe a little more safe to proceed. But it's interesting, the stuff coming. And I keep talking about the conservatives, but they're the ones harping on it about it the most. Who was it? Candace Bergen, I think, says something about the public is suffering. The public is suffering that we're not getting the... It's the language that they use rather than the point that they're trying to make. Because, and I think I said this before, the king of the pirogue, Stephen Harper, was like used getting out of going to Parliament to dodge all kinds of things, right? There was that confidence motion, and it was like, well, I'm going to prorogue. He's using the tools of Parliament to just say, we are not going to sit. But now we've got COVID-19, and that's being used. I don't think it's being used as an excuse not to sit. It's more like, let's say, extenuating circumstances that, massive extenuating circumstances that they can't sit properly. But I wonder if they're going to just keep harping on about it, or...
Well, this is one of the things...
You're hurting Parliament. It's damaged. It's injured. It's like, well, it's still sort of going. Like, hurting it would be nothing happened altogether, which they could potentially do, right? They could say, nope, not safe. Sorry, we're not doing it.
Yeah, the Trudeau government could theoretically just straight on say, we're proroguing Parliament. And, you know, we're just not going to... We're going to treat everything like it's an emergency measure, and that would be one way. I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this was because of that dichotomy. We should have some form of functioning government as close to regular order as possible. We should have things like fiscal updates. And when you mentioned that, you know, mid-March was when all this like really started. The budget was supposed to come down in late March, and it's same for the Ontario too, because the fiscal is April to March. So the budget really should have came down. I appreciate that the budget picture is different now because of COVID and all the things that have had to be made. But in order to give us a starting point, that budget should have probably been pretty close to finished.
Yep.
And in terms of just the starting point, like when we were going to start the fiscal year in April 2020, this is what it was going to look like. Obviously, things have changed now. All this spending we were going to do on I don't know, cyber cows or whatever the heck they were going to invest in.
Apps.
Apps.
We need an app AI, for the budget.
What, you know, whatever they were going to do, whatever, you know, red meat they were going to give out. Obviously, that's on the table. Any red meat now is going all straight into COVID response.
Beyond beef. It's gone beyond beef, I think. Yeah. Yes.
The problem is just I feel like Andrew Scheer misses the performative aspect of the regular sittings. He misses, you know, the jeering, the leering, the calling out Trudeau, these pontifications. It's question period he and the others miss.
Yeah.
It's not the actual governance. They miss, like,
getting the shots in.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is to do with the fact that a new leader is on the way. Scheer's definitely giving it his all, considering he's yesterday's man. Mm-hmm. He's almost 2 days ago, man, I guess. And there was just, I guess we should touch on it briefly, the French debate. Did you see any? I just heard a bit of it and saw a little piece of it on the news. And I'm surprised they even got that much coverage. It's pretty much O'Toole v. McKay. And then the other two, yeah, a French debate among the four of those, people assembled is pretty difficult because the French is tragic.
Yeah, no. Well, it's funny you should mention that too, because under normal circumstances, this would be Andrew Scheer's last week on the job. The convention was supposed to be next weekend.
Right. So he's having many, many, many last weeks on the job.
Right. Yeah. So,
and that's not till August, right? And it's a mail-in, so they're okay with mail-in ballots, I guess. So it's no.
Well,
you vote by hand via Zoom is not happening. They're going to mail it in, and then by September, sometime, there will be a new leader named Peter McKay. No,
I think that's probably not too far from the truth, especially since Eric Sloan opens up his debate maneuver in the French language, calling on, you know, the end to abortion, which, you know, by the
way,
was
that his the opener? Yeah, because that's all he's got, right?
Welcome to 1978 with Derek Sloan.
1878, yeah.
But yeah, I just feel like, and I wrestle this with this myself. But you know, at the end of the day, when Parliament's in session, it's not just the 338 members; it is all of their staffs. It is all the people who, you know, keep Parliament Hill going in terms of like a functioning sense, the caretakers and the assistants and the security people. And of course, there's also, you know, people who have been working at Parliament Hill because they're part of the essential functionings of government. And you know, it's easy to say, well, here are 338 people. Can't they just be in this big room together all wearing masks? And wouldn't that just be fine? Well, no, it's because, you know, there's more at stake than that. And, you know, I think you're just opening up a big old Petri dish. So, I mean, it's a fun thought exercise. But at the end of the day, understanding that Trudeau and the Liberals could be doing better, they could also be doing a lot worse.
Absolutely. Well, I can't believe it, but the hour once again has flown by. We're going to have to leave everything there, park it until next week. At which point, the same topics, no, I don't. We'll see. We will have a new round of topics for you 7 days from now. The exact time would be 5 p.m. Adam, how can people reach you or find out about what you are doing?
I am on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to guelphpolitico.ca.
And I'm Scotty Hertz. You can find me on Facebook at Scotty Hertz and on Twitter at Scotty Hertz, and you can find me here every Thursday at 5. from the secret, super secret location, and we're going to maintain that until further notice. But CFRU rocks on from all over, we're getting worldwide stuff these days. But yeah, so stay tuned because there's lots of new content. I absolutely love that Tango show that's on before us. Take a half an hour before Open Sources and tune into that because it's an absolute beautiful thing. And tune in as much as you can, but particularly next week at 5 p.m. for another episode of Open Sources. Take care, folks, and thanks for joining us once again.